No war has been more of a failure than the war on drugs. Despite all the crackdowns, prison sentences and moral posturing, drug use in Britain is on an epic scale, with new danger on the horizon, like fentanyl. Despite all the evidence that it's the most vulnerable in our society that fall prey to drug abuse, that prison is no deterrent but introduces offenders to more drug taking, and that police interventions on the street make it more likely for those interrogated to use more drugs, debate and policy are full of moral declarations characterised by lack of bravery and refusal to acknowledge the evidence. Professor Alex Stevens is a veteran of this field. He's Professor of Criminal Justice at the University of Kent, and he was a member of the UK Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs from 2014 to 2019, and President of the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy from 2015 to 2019. And he's just published a book, Drug Policy Constellations: The Role of Power and Morality in the Making of Drug Policy in the UK. Alex, thanks for joining us on the We Society podcast.
Absolute pleasure.
We Society, what did you make of it when you first heard us talking about this?
I love the title. In my field of drug policy, there's a lot of people trying to analyse it in terms of the sum total of individual decisions. But as a sociological criminologist, I'm much more interested in what emerges from collective action. And drug policy is one of those things that you wouldn't design it like this. No one individual would design drug policy in its current form. It arises through this emergence from these different negotiations between what I call different policy constellations. That fascinates me.
How did you get interested in this area?
It's a rather strange journey. My first degree was in French and European Studies, but we did an arts project in collaboration with the English National Opera that was working with young offenders in Feltham Young Offenders Institution, as well as students from the University of Sussex. And that just got me thinking, doing artwork with creative, imaginative, ingenious young people who'd been locked up for often horrible things they'd done. How did they get there? What was different about their life compared to my life that produced that outcome for them compared to the much more pleasant outcome I was achieving? A lot of it was around drugs and drug markets. And so I just thought about, well, we're obviously failing here because these young people, they shouldn't be in prison. We shouldn't be producing the social circumstances that provided those choices for them. So how do we do something about that?
Let's just nail down the scale of this. I mean, who's taking drugs? How many of them? How many are regular drug users? Give us a sense of this.
Well, in a way, we're all taking drugs. Most of us consume caffeine, alcohol, have smoked tobacco. So those are all drugs, and most of us use them. If we're talking about those drugs that are controlled under the Misuse of Drugs Act, there's about 10% of the adult population that uses an illicit drug each year. That's a remarkably stable figure. It stayed like that for about 25 years.
Really?
Yes.
Is it mainly the young, or is it all age groups?
It's concentrated in young people, and the rates amongst the youngest tends to fluctuate more. So it was falling from a historic high in the mid-90s down to about 2013. Seems to have bounced back a bit since then. But it's young people in the age group where they're just coming into adulthood. Students have a higher rate than others. People who have some spare time, a bit of cash, and want to explore the outer limits of their consciousness.
Is it the same kind of drugs? I mean,
well, cannabis is still and has always been the most common of the illicit drugs, but that's not the main problem. There are some people who have problems with cannabis use, but in this country, the main problem is still heroin. We have an ongoing public health crisis of drug-related deaths in the UK and especially in Scotland. Since the end of the West European heroin drought, which was in 2010 to 2012, there's been a consistent rise. Deaths have more than doubled since then. And especially in the most deprived areas, we have record levels of drug-related deaths, most of which are to do with heroin in combination with other substances like alcohol and benzodiazepines.
So how many people are we talking about?
We're talking about more than 4,500 people dying every year in the UK of drug-related deaths.
Largely from heroin, huh?
About half heroin, but often with other substances. Cocaine has become more of a presence in those death figures as availability has increased of cocaine based on coca from Colombia, which had a big increase in production since 2013. There's now a lot of concern, but the numbers aren't huge yet, around potent synthetic opioids. So we've had heroin growing in the UK. Well, that's till about 1990, we had a growth in heroin use. That seems to have plateaued off, and there isn't much of a young generation replacing those people who are dying with heroin. But we have seen an still in the tens up to hundreds of people dying with things like fentanyl, which is a much more potent synthetic opioid. And in the last couple of years, nitazenes, which are even more potent. And there's been clusters of deaths and overdoses in various parts of the country.
Yes, there's talk of that just beginning to grow in Britain, isn't there?
That's right. I've been looking at that with the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C., where they're very concerned about it because we're talking a massive problem in the U.S. where fentanyl has basically overtaken heroin as the main illicit opioid in the system. And associated with that, there's been a massive increase in deaths.
Why is the attraction to fentanyl? Conscience raising, kind of make you feel good? I mean, what's the attraction of it?
Normally what happens is that it's attractive to dealers because it's cheap and so powerful that it's very, very easy to smuggle because it's tiny quantities you need to get people high. The pattern normally is that people don't know they're taking it until it's too late. So fentanyl entered the illicit market in the US. People thought they were buying heroin, they were getting fentanyl. Then it's so potent their tolerance goes up and then they want want fentanyl because the heroin's no longer powerful enough for them. In this country, the deaths we've seen with fentanyl have been people who think they're taking heroin but fentanyl is in it by contamination.
What drives drug use? I mean, you said at the outset of this that actually it's people, actually young people, exploring the outer limits of kind of human experience and their consciousness and actually kind of pleasure seeking, kind of raising their sense of smell or sense of taste or whatever it is. And then there's drug use which stems from social deprivation, where you are literally, people talk about deaths of despair. Mm-hmm. Excess drug use, and some of these people have got a lot to be desperate about. The objective circumstances of their lives are disaster areas. What's your view?
So people often ask me, why do people take drugs? In most cases, the answer is quite simple. People find it pleasurable to take drugs. Lots of the substances that have been banned, people find enlightening, pleasurable, make them feel better, make them have more fun. But the problem with that is that that's not the only thing these substances do. I mean, I did some research for my last book on drugs, crime and public health about the social distribution of drug use. And what I found was that illicit drug use is actually more common in more affluent groups. But problematic use, daily use, use associated with health problems, is much more common in more deprived groups. And there's a socio-ecological model of the development of problematic drug use, which talks about going from people born into adverse circumstances, having adverse experiences in their childhood, that they might be self-medicating with various drugs. They start drug use quite early, in the early teens. That leads on to development of more serious drug problems. And so for those people, it's no longer a pleasure. I mean, I've lost count of the number of times people have told me who are dependent on heroin that I don't do this. It doesn't give me any pleasure anymore. I just do it to stay well because they've got a dependence that if they stop taking that heroin, they feel incredibly ill. And it's just a way of keeping themselves from feeling unwell that keeps them taking heroin.
Even as it destroys them.
Indeed.
Gosh.
But it is possible to take heroin without being destroyed. The people who are prescribed a pharmaceutical dose of heroin can do that for decades without damaging their health. It's all the life circumstances that go around illicit use of heroin, the other health problems that come with it. For example, if you're injecting drugs in street-based locations that are far
dirty
from hygienic,
needles,
you're likely to get an abscess, you're likely to get infections, you're likely also to be smoking, your lungs are likely to deteriorate because of that. Heroin kills by depressing the respiratory system. So if you've already got problems with your lungs and then you overdose, you're much more likely to die. So it's this whole concatenation of social and health problems, often alongside mental health problems, that is fatal.
Society isn't good at this. I mean, despite all the efforts at containing it and constraining it, as you say, 10% of the adult population is taking drugs every year, despite everything. And yet, it seems impossible to get a kind of square conversation about this. Should one decriminalise drug use? Should one tax drugs? Should one regulate drugs to ensure that, that the drugs that people feel compelled to take are safer? It's a potential source of tax revenue. I mean, I bow to you, but you're the man. I mean, you're the man who knows about the answers.
Well, let's break it down a bit by drug. So if we were to think about cannabis, for example, what would be the likely outcome of that being legalised? Well, we're seeing that natural experiments happening.
There are. It's been in the States,
Germany. Germany's just about to do it. And there are it's evidence from some of the states that have done it that if you allow a free market and you allow advertising, you allow marketing, just as with, you know, when cigarettes were, you could do price promotions on them, you could advertise them, cigarette use is quite high. Through a combination of public health measures, we've managed to get a handle on that, and cigarette use and the deaths associated with it are falling. Now, there's no reason you shouldn't be able to apply those sorts of regulations to a cannabis market, apart from the politics are so complicated. In the States, for example, they have what I think is quite a ridiculous ruling from the Supreme Court that commercial speech is free speech, and therefore it's much harder to clamp down on things like advertising. I wouldn't want there to be an advertised free market for cannabis in this country because I think that would predictably increase harms. And I also am more sceptical about having a legalised market for things that are lethal in overdose. Cannabis is not lethal in overdose. People might have problems if they leave it lying around and their kids get it. They might have paranoid episodes that we don't want to happen. There are people who are vulnerable to mental health problems. We don't want them to be overusing cannabis. So there's that problem. But with things like heroin, that if you accidentally take it, you're very likely to die. We don't necessarily want a free market in that.
I think not.
So the question becomes, how do you balance the harms that come from a drug with the harms that come from attempts to control it? At the moment, I think we've got the balance wrong, but I wouldn't say that the answer is to create a legalised market for everything.
Walk us through how you'd rebalance it.
Okay. In my previous book on drugs, crime, and public health, I talked about progressive decriminalisation, a series of evidence-informed steps towards a more liberal approach, starting with the decriminalisation of possession of all drugs. There's no good evidence that threatening people with punishment for using drugs stops them using drugs or reduces the problems. There is good evidence it does serious damage to people's life prospects. So the question there is, why are we doing something which is expensive, harmful, and ineffective? We could stop doing that by decriminalising possession of all drugs.
How many folk in British overcrowded prisons are there for drug offences?
About 16% the last time I counted. Of prisoners that are in there for drug offences. But most of that is for drug supply and trafficking. There's not that many. There's a few hundred people every year imprisoned for possession offences, normally because they've done it a few times, or we're talking about reasonably large quantities where there's some suspicion that they were dealing as well.
Yeah. So go back to your logic. I mean, you were talking about kind of, so certainly decriminalising possession is something that you'd do.
Yes. So in cannabis, you might therefore look at, you know, other models of supply, because a lot of the problem with cannabis is the criminalisation of the market and therefore the incentivisation for organised criminal groups to develop violent and exploitative methods for cultivating and trading that. So you might want to think about, well, there's lots of people out there who want to grow their own cannabis. Lots of them are using it for medical purposes. Why don't we let people grow their own cannabis, a small number of plants per person? Now, if everyone's got an allowance of, say, 5 plants per person, why don't we allow groups of people to pool their allowance? This is a model known as cannabis social clubs that's worked in Spain, for example. And then you might think, well, if you evaluate that step and you think, well, we're not seeing lots of diversion, we're not seeing lots of problems with it, well, then could we think about licensed premises where people could buy or even consume cannabis? And that, you know, similar to coffee shops in Amsterdam, which have had their problems, but generally...
So you could resuscitate Britain's declining pub population by turning them into have some rooms and be a public bar where you'd smoke marijuana, maybe.
Well, people have tried setting those up and have normally been fairly quickly clamped down on in this country. I mean, you raise the point of tax revenue as well, which is interesting. I think there's the estimates vary wildly between what we might gain in terms of tax revenue. And it all depends about where we put the price. Now, cannabis is actually a really cheap product to produce. There are places in this country using the excess heat from, for example, sugar beet factories to power big greenhouses where cannabis is grown.
But the authorities must know where they are. They can't.
These are legal properties.
Oh, I see.
The UK is one of the biggest exporters of medical cannabis in the world. Cannabis is not some sort of foreign substance. It's in our economy already. The question is, how much do we want in our economy?
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organisation behind the We Society podcast. The general election may be over, but that's only the beginning for the new government, as it has many pressing challenges to sort out. From education to the economy, every aspect of our society is crying out for fresh ideas and solutions. Social science stands ready to step up to the plate. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. We champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. What constellations of alliance are required, and what would be, in your view, early wins or early, early wins, let's call them wins?
One of the problems I've observed in more than a decade of doing policy advice is that people often argue for evidence-based policy, as if by showing politicians the evidence, that will be persuasive enough to get them to change their minds. That has repeatedly failed to happen, including in my own attempts to do this.
It's not so much they may be persuaded by the evidence, and they may actually be with you, but they just think that the collateral damage that you know, the kind of hits you'll get from the media are so huge that actually it's not worth the candle. There are other ways they want to consume their political capital.
I don't think it's as instrumental as that. I think in drug policy, and I'd be really interested in your views on other areas of policy, that people have quite deeply held moral positions, what I call ethico-political bases. Therefore, we have to think about what does work. And in my book, the new book on drug policy constellations, I give examples, case studies of how drug policy has been changed. And it's fascinating. The constellations of actors, the types of power they bring to this, and the ethico-political bases that inform their work.
This is what states in America, Holland, wherever it might be, where drug policy has changed, you've kind of looked
at it. Well, the three cases I've looked at are the partial legalization of medical cannabis, which happened here in 2018.
Yeah.
The drug strategy of 2021, in which Boris Johnson, very surprisingly, invested more than £500 million in drug treatment services, which had been cut for the previous decade. And also the differences in the response to drug-related deaths between England and Scotland. And Scotland has developed a more progressive approach, I would argue, partly because it has different ethico-political bases to its political discussions.
It's also got more heroin deaths.
That's right.
I mean, it's a more pressing and a live issue.
Yes, and the narrative that was used from both left and right in Scotland to get a much greater and quicker investment in doing something about that was that that was a national shame. Again, not an evidence-based argument, a deeply moral argument about what policy should be about.
So you're taking a new tack in which you say, I'm going to fight kind of moral fire with moral fire, in a sense.
Indeed. So I talk in the book about what I call affective power.
So affective.
Affect.
With an A.
That's right, with an A. So it's about mood, sentiment and emotion. How do you get people not just to know that something works, but also to feel that it's right? And a lot of the work that's done by very savvy political operators is to use affective power by using emotive stories. And so, for example, the way that medical cannabis was legalized in 2018 was partly because there'd been a body of evidence built up around the usefulness of cannabis in medical treatment, the lack of danger of allowing more liberal approaches. But the immediate cause was a very savvy political operator using the very affective stories of young boys who were suffering multiple epileptic seizures and challenging ministers.
Who was that operator? Just name him or her.
He's named in the book, Steve Moore. So he was an advisor to David Cameron. If you remember the Big Society,
yep. He
was deeply involved in that idea. He developed a plan, which he learnt from how it had been done in the States and other countries, that if you get a very affective story about especially a child that is suffering because of this policy, you can put politicians in a corner from which the only way out is to do what he wanted, other people wanted, the ill wanted, which was to legalise cannabis for medical purposes, which was done on the 1st of November 2018.
That's very much what the footballer Marcus Rashford achieved with his school dinners campaign. It was very affective, wasn't it?
Exactly, but it's not just the individual who's Marcus Rashford or Billy Caldwell, who was the young boy involved, and Charlotte Caldwell, his mum. In the case of Marcus Rashford, you had an organisation called the Food Foundation working behind that, producing all the evidence, informing the media about the stats around it. And then Marcus Rashford steps in as a very popular, high-profile figure who can trigger that policy cornering. And in this case, you know, you had this very savvy political operator, Steve Moore, working with a very determined mother on the behalf of a highly suffering child, but also bringing to play things that my friend and colleague David Nutt, the research he's done over decades, around the uses of cannabis. So it's this constellation of people, ideas, evidence, emotion, morality that we have to take account of if we want to understand how policy change happens.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very, very interesting approach. And I can see that. I can see why you champion it. Suppose you get your kind of ducks in a row on that. Then what would be your first two or three targets?
Well, like I say, with Niamh Eastwood, I've written a paper on decriminalisation and how we should do it. It's very simple.
This is decriminalisation for possession.
Of possession, of simple possession of drugs. You could do that by repealing sections 5.1 and 5.2 of the Misuse of Drugs Act, which are those sections which make it a criminal offence to be in possession of small quantities with no evidence that you're going to supply those substances.
Because what happens here is that the press mm-hmm. come up with counter effective mm-hmm. stories, don't they?
Yes.
I mean, that's the point. So yes. it's yes. a balance between the struggle of the effective stories.
Exactly. Yes. So, I mean, when, for example, David Blunkett downgraded cannabis from Class B to Class C, over the next few years, you saw a lot of effective stories of around teenage boys who'd got mental health problems. Now, I'm not saying that's not a problem. There are young men who suffer mental health problems often while they're using cannabis. The question of whether it's cannabis that causes the mental health problems or vice versa is more tricky.
Yeah.
But that doesn't tend to... those complications aren't the stuff of headlines. The stuff of headlines is my son took cannabis and went mad. And so that is a very effective way and was effective in getting cannabis put back in Class B.
Yeah.
And that had no effect whatsoever on levels of use. We look at trends in patterns of use, whether when it went down to C, it was falling at the time. It was put down to C, it kept on falling. When it went up back to Class B, there was no change. I mean, in terms of mental health admissions, they actually increased after it was put back into Class B, having had been falling in the period it was in Class C. So there's a lack of link between this deterrent threat of what class or what punishment drugs are going to get you and the actual evidence on what happens with drug. So this is why I say that drug possession and its criminalisation is a futile and costly waste of money and our time. Look at the tobacco control success story we've got. We've gone from, you know, nearly half of adult smoking to much smaller proportions of doing that. And that's not by punishing people for using cigarettes. It's about changing the environment in which people are using cigarettes. And for me, we need to change the environment in which people are taking drugs, including heroin. We need to stop producing child poverty, which produces adverse childhood experiences, which produces the kinds of people who are likely to seek solace in heroin and get stuck there. So we can't punish people out of using heroin. We can give them treatments that reduce their prospects of dying. But the long-term solution is in doing away with the social conditions that produce problematic heroin use.
This is equally kind of challenging as actually trying, you know, to create a society which had kind of less holes in the floor of a social provision you're trying to provide through which people can drop is, of course, the aim of all good social scientists and all good people working in social policy, but it's damn hard to deliver.
Absolutely, but if you were to take all the problems you've talked about in this podcast, and many of the people will come here in front of this microphone and say, well, we need to stop creating the social conditions that produce the social problem. So, you know, reducing child poverty wouldn't just prevent lots of drug-related deaths over the next few decades. Many of the other problems talked about would be lessened. In the meanwhile, we could stop this crazy game of pretending to ourselves that just by threatening people and adding one more intervention to, you know, the long list of things we've tried to do to deter people from using these substances which don't have evidence. I mean, that's one of the things that really frustrates me. I call it interventionitis.
Interventionitis.
The idea that just the next intervention is going to be the one that tips the scales over when we know perfectly well that's not going to happen.
What is your kind of utopian vision? I mean, hold our hand and take us onto Elysian fields. Where would they be on this issue?
I don't think we need to go to utopia to find better drug policies. They exist in Europe. You know, Switzerland, for example, has this four-pillar approach around supply reduction, demand reduction, treatment and harm reduction, which has been much more effective than our approach in limiting the
deaths. Our approach is essentially criminalizing and repressing, isn't it?
And some treatment. So, no, compared to the States, as in many aspects of social policy, we're somewhere mid-Atlantic.
Yeah.
So if you look at the sorts of policies that are operating in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, the Netherlands, they're very much more health-focused than we are, and the States is even less health-focused and has far fewer people in the effective forms of drug treatment. There are several countries in Europe, for example, that have over 80% of the people who are dependent on heroin are in what's known as opioid agonist therapy, and that things like methadone and buprenorphine that have repeatedly been shown to reduce use of street heroin and reduce the risk of death. We're around 40%, and we need to get up near 80% because that would save lives.
Right. So in this area, we look European.
We look half European, half American, I suppose.
No, but we should look more European.
We should look to Europe, as in many areas of social policy and crime policy. We should look to Europe, not the States. The States is a disaster for drug policy, as we're seeing in the thousands and thousands of deaths that are taking place every year now.
Interestingly, I was I've recently been had occasion to speak to some senior figures in the US military who say that recruitments of high school graduates in the US military, that's only kind of one in four you can take. And that one of the reasons is that, you know, disciplinary problems, but also drug abuse. And actually it's kind of, you know, and the fact that they don't attend to this correctly. You know, there's 40,000 too few people in the American Navy. They just can't get the people because they can't. It's actually striking at the sinews of American military power.
Yes, and the problem is partly their individualistic approach to thinking and talking about this. They still have a mindset where a drug problem is an individual problem, a moral failing that person has. And they're not inclined to see this as a social problem. Going back to our initial conversation about the We Society, these are collectively produced problems to which we must have collective solutions, not blaming each individual or treating one person at a time. We need to create the social conditions by which we avoid young people developing the kind of mental health problems that lead to problematic substance use.
Okay, so if your concluding remarks, bullet points on what those collective actions should be in your view.
Let's start with the two-child benefit cap, the two-child limit. That is a deliberate policy to reduce the incomes of the poorest families. It is those poorest families that are most vulnerable to producing children who are going to have drug problems in the future. So why on earth are we deliberately inflicting poverty on those families? This is consistent with my general view that the best drug policy is a good social policy. We're not going to get drug policies that get us out of drug problems. This is a social problem that needs social solutions. Increase the number of people who are in opioid agonist therapy if they need it.
Opioid
agonist therapy, methadone, buprenorphine, okay. Buvidal. And that's done by just talking to those people and asking them what it is that they want. At the moment, the last 15, 20 years, we've had an obsession with threatening people into treatment by saying, well, we've got to use the criminal justice system to increase the numbers. That has not worked. It's not working as we speak. There are projects that are using criminal justice levers, trying to pull those to get more people into treatment. We're just not seeing that increase. We need to talk to people who are using drugs, say, what is it that you want? We need to create a person-centered, trauma-informed treatment system that is welcoming, open, and retaining these people in treatment.
And I'm going to give you one more, and then we're going to wrap it up.
Well, if we're going to get really utopian, could we place a ban on politicians saying stupid things about drugs and being rewarded for it in the media?
Now that really is utopian. Look, it's been fascinating. Your numbers suggest there's about 3 million people regularly using drugs in the UK, that in parts of the country, in Scotland in particular, there's 4,500 people every year dying of heroin use. You're essentially saying that a policy of criminalisation and repression has not really effectively kind of lowered those numbers, which actually pose phenomenal risks that... You suggested the kind of approach in the States, which actually, because it's individuals' choices which have led to the kind of moral deprivation of being drug abuse, that hasn't worked there at all. And that actually one should look to some European models where things have worked, and actually in our own backyard. And you really want people to talk straight about drugs. That's ultimately where you are. Alex Stevens, thank you so much. It's been a very interesting podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton. The episode was produced by Emily Finch and was a Whistledown production for the Academy of Social Sciences. Be sure to subscribe to the We Society on the podcast hosting platform of your choosing so you can be the first to hear new episodes, and go to acss.org.uk to learn more about the Academy of Social Sciences.